Better make sure it's not a dead plug over there.
No, because I've got power here. Okay. Yeah, we're all right now.
Yeah.
It's working.
Just reluctant.
As I indicated to you in my letter, I'd like to start with some of your early background, and
okay.
then let's see where what our time
sure.
constraints are. Just for the record, let me say that this is Tuesday, October 23rd, 1990, and Jim Boning talking to Dr. Norman Hackerman in his office at the Welsh Foundation in Houston. Dr. Hackerman, I know you were born on March 2nd, 1912 in Baltimore. Could you tell me something about your parents and your family background?
Sure. Both of my parents were immigrants. They came to the country as kids. I think my father was 6 years old and mother was probably a little older. Separately they came. Neither of them had any schooling before they came. And my mother had about 2 or 3 years of schooling after, and my father had none, never had any. He went to work, I'm told, as an 8-year-old kid, and just worked all of his life. He developed the capacity to read, never did, wasn't able to write very much, he could sign his name. He was a tailor, and ended up as a manager or foreman of a tailoring factory in East Baltimore, working for a large company. I had one sister, and as with most immigrant people, they were insisting that we go to school, and both of us went to college. We were obviously not well-to-do, but they made do. Sister went to Goucher College, got a bachelor's degree there. This was Baldwin. And I went to Hopkins and went into what's known as a new plan. And the new plan was a 6-year PhD with no intermediates. I'm jumping a little ahead of the story, but when it became apparent in the midst of the Depression that that people without BAs were going to be hard to sell to employers, that is, with a PhD only, I slowed down and gave them the $10 for the diploma and got a BA while I was at it. So I got both my degrees at Hopkins. Fact is that my parents really worked hard to make sure that we could go to school, both my sister and I. I worked during that time, she worked during that time, but that was a pittance. We both went to private schools. They were both in Baltimore, so we could live at home. But still, it was pretty expensive. As I remember, the tuition was $900 a year, which in 1929 was a major sum. And even riding back and forth in a streetcar for a 10-cent a ride was a problem. But we managed all right, and Hopkins was a good place for me, and I think Goucher was a good place for my sister.
Could I back up for a moment, and could we talk about growing up in Baltimore and your earlier education?
Yeah.
Did you go to public schools, and grade school, and high school?
All public schools. The principal thing I can remember about my grade school education was what I'd call domineering women as teachers. I guess the difference in height makes a difference, but they were good teachers in the sense that they insisted on self-discipline, on study, and that certainly didn't hurt me. I enjoyed that. But I have a memory of only two of them. One was a third grade teacher, whose name I can't remember. One was a fourth grade teacher, whose name was Mrs. Meyer. And I remember them because while they were both dominant, they were the bad guy, good guy kind of operation. The third grade teacher was I remember as a tough lady, and the fourth grade teacher was a nice lady. But basically they were instrumental in providing for what I consider to be the important process in education, namely self-learning. Teachers are fine, and they do help the guy, and they can explain a few things. But back then, it seems to me, I got an instinctive feel for the fact that if you're going to learn, you have to do it yourself.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting.
Which I think is quite important.
Mm-hmm.
That's all I remember, the grade school. The junior high school was an interesting mixed bag because I went to a high school where maybe for the first time they got crowded enough that they had to build some portables. I guess that's what they still call them. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure. There's temporary shacks. And my class, the seventh grade, went into those portables. And I remember more about portables than I do about what I learned there. Mm-hmm. Except for one thing. This was in a working class neighborhood over in East Baltimore. And in 7th, 8th, and 9th grades each, I had shops. I had tin shop, machine shop, wood shop, and print shop. And it's quite obvious that what the kids were being prepared for was a job. I'm not all that great with my hands, so I was lucky and didn't fall into the trap of going in that direction. But it did leave an impression with me, that several impressions. One of them is it would be nice to be handy. Some of the kids that I was with were quite capable carpenters. Not many of us were good print setters. And besides that, I was on the verge of being an obsolescent activity. The Mergenthaler machine was already operating pretty well. And my best memory of the print shop was we had an irate Scotchman as a teacher. And he made no bones about being irritated when we pied the print, which was frequent. But I had no impression of classes at the PS 47, that was the junior high school. And, you know, back, I guess you had too, but back there, the schools were numbered. Mm-hmm. I had PS 27 as a grade school and PS 47 as a junior high school. But I had some vivid impressions of my high school. And they're varied. The first year, the one I went to, the high school I went to, was called Baltimore City College. And not improperly so, because, see, I entered in 1925. I finished in 28, had 3 years. So I entered in 25. Up through that year, there were people who went directly from that high school into state medical schools without any intermediate college training. And the city had an educational system in which there was this Baltimore City College. There was a Baltimore Polytechnic Institute, which was engineering-oriented. A girls' high school known as Eastern High School, and the girls' high school known as Western High School. And then, and by the way, the City College and Polytechnic were male only.
Mm.
And then they had one co-ed school called Forest Park High School, which was on the far west side of town and the direction in which the city was building. So that was the modern sort. City College and Poly, City and Poly, were very, very intense 11th through 12th grade, 10th through 12th grade educational systems, much more difficult than current colleges in terms of what they ask you to do and what they expected of you in return for what you heard. For example, I had, now this was 1925-28, I had math through calculus. I had an introductory biology course, a full year of physics, and 2 years of chemistry, including laboratories. I took organic chemistry in high school. And it's clear to me that the reason I stayed in chemistry was because of that place. Predominantly, if a kid, particularly from the east side of town, went on to college, to college and passed, he was expected to be a doctor, a medical doctor. In the yearbook of the year I graduated from City, it says I was going to study chemistry. And I'm convinced that, that was my fourth semester of chemistry, that it was Dr. Ingram and Mr. Robb, who were my instructors, that, but that didn't push me. I can't remember being pushed in that direction. Who instigated me to go into the field. I had a laboratory instructor whose name, I'm sorry to say, I don't remember. He used to work with us. There were 20 of us or so in the lab. And sort of one-on-one. Got very, very close attention.
What kind of work were you doing in the lab? Qualitative analysis the first year, and were you doing synthesis work in organic?
Yes, simple syntheses. Separations. Purification. I mean, the works, by and large, I really didn't have to take it in college.
You don't remember the text you used?
No, the high school text I certainly don't.
I was just wondering if it was a college level text as
the text. Well, no, I don't remember. I don't remember the classes as well as I do the labs. But it's clear that that must have had some influence on me, because I was questioned a lot by my family, my friends. What is it that you're trying to do? You want to be a pharmacist? Was that the idea? They didn't understand this business of chemistry. But the work at City was hard. The discipline was tough. And the self-discipline I'd learned in grade school stood me in good stead. And I really don't know whether many dropouts at that time. I hadn't the slightest idea. See, I do have an impression that not as many went on to high school. That the kids started going to work when they finished the ninth grade, particularly over my side of town. So those who went in, I think, stayed, or most of them stayed. The school moved around a lot during my 3 years there. I had three different sites. They had an old downtown location, and then I was in a temporary location, and then what's known as a new one. And I went back for my 60th anniversary, I guess, at the then new one, at the place which was new to me. So it's still there. Still a good school, still a highly disciplined school. Poly still does very tough studies that point toward engineering. It's a rather interesting phenomenon in itself. There are now a couple dozen high schools in the city, but these two have retained their character.
Was your
both co-ed incident?
When you went there, was it automatic, or did you because of where you were living, or was this you had to select, and was there an entrance exam?
Both. If you wanted to go into engineering, the best thing to do is to go to Poly. If you want to go into medicine, the best thing to do is go to City. If you want to do what I want to do, which of course I didn't know at the time, City would have been the place. It was a liberal arts type versus the engineering type.
Mm-hmm.
And the answer to your question about an entrance exam, I don't think there was a formal entrance exam, but they could somehow deter you. Now remember, there weren't a whole lot of choices. There were just three schools I could have gone to. This co-ed, which would have meant two times as long streetcar ride, or these two, or go to work. But I believe they filtered them out, Poly, for example, by a very tough early math in the entering year. At City, the math was a little less difficult, so that the non-engineer types had physicists nobody knew about, but engineers, MDs, pharmacists, that kind of thing, profession-oriented.
When you went there, what did you have in mind? You picked this over Poly, so obviously engineering wasn't something that... but did you have anything specific in mind?
Probably medicine.
Medicine.
Yeah.
Were your parents influential?
I don't know, sir.
Were your parents influential in that?
Yeah. Not influential in any overt sense, but you could tell that when they talked about doctors, that was the epitome.
Mm-hmm.
Doctors were looked on, almost godlike quality in those days.
Yes.
I don't know if they deserved it, but that was the case. So that was the peak of what a person from that condition could do. Business was not an important thing to them. Law wasn't very, interestingly enough, it's not that important. But if you want to be professional over my part of town, you became a dentist or a doctor. Or a pharmacist. Pharmacist is a very honorable position.
Mm-hmm.
At that time, pharmacists did a lot of prescribing. If you had a cold, you didn't run to the doctor. You went over to the corner pharmacy and he gave you something. Usually rhinitis pills. I'm sorry, so.
You said that your father did a lot of reading. Had you been doing a lot of reading during this time as well?
No, I said my father learned to read.
Oh, okay.
He learned to read. And he read somewhat laboriously, but he read newspapers pretty assiduously. I did a lot of reading, but I think that came from my exposure to PS-27, because we did a lot of reading in class. For example, there was one mistake that the educational system made on me, at least one. It suddenly occurred to me. When I got to the third grade, I had a very nice handwriting, on the carefully written A, B, and C. And during handwriting class or whatever it was, but when they practiced it, Miss Dominger is his name, by the way, let me sit in the back of the room and read, because my writing was pretty good. And I did a lot of reading in the third grade. And that sort of instilled the reading habit. But my reputation preceded me, so I didn't do much practice in the fourth and fifth and sixth grades. And when I got to the seventh, where we had to start taking notes, I did develop a problem. I had to start writing fast, whereas I learned to write slowly and carefully. And my handwriting's terrible. Most people can't read it, including me. I don't close the A's, so they look like C-E. Don't close the D's, they look like C-L. The U's look like N's and so on. W's like N's. So it's a scrawl, and you have to know the gist of what I'm writing about to get any idea. Few of the ladies that have worked for me can read it better than I can, but most people can't read it. And that I have to ascribe to the third grade, where I really should have had some handwriting lessons.
How was the decision made to go to Hopkins then? I'm assuming now you've got chemistry fixed is what
the
you want to pursue.
Chemistry, and my guess would be in, say, December of my senior year. Early enough so I could get into the yearbook, so that would have to be about that, at least by that time. And the choice of where to go was fairly limited. It would have to be someplace in Baltimore or close by, because I couldn't afford to live on campus. Well, there was Loyola College, mm-hmm. which is a Catholic college, and fairly difficult to get into except through an affiliation with the church. Hopkins, the University of Maryland, which was a long way off, 25 miles or so between Washington and Baltimore, 30 miles maybe, closer to Washington than it was to Baltimore. So the one would have to take a local train and get to it, local B&O. And I can't remember if there was any question as to whether I'd be admitted to Hopkins. I had to fill out the usual papers, but my record at City was good. And this was 1928-29, and I can't remember, but I think I applied only to Hopkins, and they took me. I couldn't get a scholarship because they were awfully hard to get. Hopkins was, by the time I entered there in the fall of 28, was beginning to show some strains that preceded the big stock market crash, because I'm interpolating here, so because the trustees had invested heavily in the B&O Railroad. The chairman of the board was the president of B&O. They invested heavily in the B&O Railroad, and it was already showing signs of pointing toward bankruptcy. By the end of my first year there, when stock market had not yet broken, I don't remember anybody who was on scholarship in the freshman and sophomore class. Doesn't mean there wasn't any, but I don't remember any. And then by October of that year, there was just no question that nobody, the university couldn't help, because it was busted. In fact, the faculty wasn't getting paid. How they hung on, I haven't the slightest idea.
And that's before the Depression?
No, it was just after it started, yeah. Mm-hmm. But Hopkins already was showing signs of it because it improperly invested, unwisely invested, not improperly. So as I recall, we weren't hit by the Depression as badly as many, because my father kept his job. But his little savings and SNL got wiped out. And I haven't the slightest idea how they scraped the money together for the next year. I was working. I sold women's shoes and so forth, and I took care of the sort of operating expenses. But the $900 for tuition was a major problem. He may have borrowed it. That's one possibility. The following year, it was the same. My last year, I had a little relief. I got some kind of a, it's hard to remember. remember whether it was a scholarship or a work, kind of a teaching assistantship as a senior. But I got some help and eased up on it. But I finished the PhD in 3 years. So the whole shebang took 7 instead of the 6 I told you the new plan had called for. And I did finish in the 7 years, and I believe that my parents paid all or most of the tuition each of those 7 years, and I took care of most of the rest of them.
Was there any overlap with your sister being in school at the same time?
Yeah, that was a problem. She's 9 years behind me, so she started 2 years into the last 2 years of my time, the first 2 years of her time, for problems. Things got a little... The Depression wasn't over in 1934 and 1935, but we probably got used to it. We knew how to cope with it. And things seemed to be a little easier at that time. For one thing, in 29, 30, and 31, you really couldn't tell where you hold your job. By the time 32, 33 came around, if you were still in there, that was pretty stable. So you could borrow money and pay it back and that kind of thing. By 35, it had hit rock bottom, and those who were working were going to continue to work if their health held up. So you didn't have the same degree of discomfort. See, when I got out in 35, there weren't any jobs. I applied for a job at Ohio State, I think, an instructorship. And it turns out there were 1,000 applications. And O.K. Rice was one of them. O.K. Rice, but at that time, was already well established. He didn't get the job instantly. I guess he wanted too much or something.
I'd like to go back and talk about your experiences at Hopkins. And sort of work our way through those 7 years. You had this extensive background before you got there. Were you able to skip some chemistry classes, or did you start right in with the normal sequence?
No, I didn't. In fact, whether it was because I'd had that chemistry in high school, or whether it was because Hopkins had a policy of not letting you start if you were majoring in chemistry in the first year, I'm not really certain. But I didn't take any chemistry my first year at all. I took some languages, I took philosophy, I took a course in psychology, took no science, no physical science at all, or natural science at all. Philosophy, psychology, English, Italian, and something like political science. Took Italian because I was interested. The instructor was an interesting guy. Philosophy because I had a chance to listen to George Boas, who I'd already heard of. Psychology because I was interested. In my second year, I took physics, chemistry, geology, and math. None of the other stuff. The physics course, and by the way, I wasn't well advised in that. I should have had the math the first year. I was taking differential equations in physics at the same time, whereas it would have been a lot better had I had the differential equations behind me. But that meant, let's see, we had 9 hours of freshman chemistry laboratory. We had 8 hours of physics laboratory. And one afternoon, I don't know how this worked out, but one afternoon a geology laboratory. So it was a pretty husky schedule. I had a man named Cartledge, G.H. Cartledge, as a gay freshman chemistry, four lectures and 9 hours of lab. And I would guess that all the chemistry I knew by the time I got a PhD, I got that first year, or all, you know, the perimeter was certainly marked out.
Do you remember what text was used?
I actually have it, but not here. Let's see. I remember it's a lot smaller than the current text. And that every week we did, you know, how they used to do it by column in the periodic table. I'll see if I can find it, but I don't remember it now. It was predominantly reading the text was fairly simple and straightforward, no great problems. I got a great deal out of Cartledge's lectures. He prepared them carefully, and you know they were sort of fully developed. I always, when I knew him in that class, I always thought of him as a dour individual. I got to know him much better when he was at Oak Ridge later, and I was in Texas. In fact, we worked together on some problems. But he was very straightforward and very clear, and he generally clarified the questions I had out of the text without being asked. So he saw the same questions the class did, I guess. It was a class of about, I'd say, 100, all pretty good students. So there's no, you know, the distribution wasn't like that. The distribution was more like this. And he knew that. He'd been there for a long time. And that meant that he produced his words at a level that got us all interested at the same time. It was fast-moving, thorough, and you could be reasonably sure he was right in the light of the day, of that day, in what he said. So it moved very rapidly. And I got to tell you, four classes versus current three, and 9 hours of lab versus the current three makes a big difference. So that you were prepared almost at the end of that year to be a chemist.
Were there many chem majors in your group?
No. I would make a guess that there were, in that 100, maximum five or six. Mm-hmm. Most of them were pre-meds. And you know, smattering of other things like geologists and so forth. But most, 80% of them would be medical. The laboratories were pretty involved. The stuff that you had to work with was all right. It wasn't outstanding. The first semester was series of experiments. Densities, reactions, whatnot. And the second semester was qual. That was tough. That was very tough.
Especially with 9 hours a week.
Yeah. And we had lots of unknowns, you know. Mm-hmm. We'd go through the system first, get one unknown. For the first group, I guess we got a couple that started to get used to the thing. Then we'd get group two, 2A and 2B separately. They were tough, I gotta tell you. They were not the easiest thing in the world to work out. You know, lots of H2S in the air.
Right.
Kip generators operating under the hoods, and the hoods not working particularly well. And there was no compromise. You turned in your report, and the guy looked it up and either put a check or an X or something. I forget what the grades were like. And if you didn't get it right, go back and do it again. The second time, you got a grade, because you couldn't stay there forever doing 2A. And you got the feeling that you knew what you were doing. You did group two, man, that was a tough group. Then you got group three, which was tough because the KSPs were not nearly as well separated or as different as they were in group two. And you finally worked your way through that. Group four was all right. Then you got to this dumb bunch of alkaline metals, and they were stinkers. Then of course you get the full thing. No, then we did anions, but anions were no great shucks. All you did was spot test them. Mm-hmm. Then you get the big deal. Tell me what's in it.
Let me just ask, in view of what you've been saying, since qualitative analysis is been rapidly disappearing from the chemistry curriculum, how you feel about that in light of your experience years ago with it?
I think that the trend away from laboratories is wrong, first of all, because there's still laboratory science. If it involves the use of computers and the computer in the laboratory, it ought to be carried out. And the qual, if you look on qual in itself as teaching you chemistry, that's not likely to happen except in a very limited fashion. If you look on qual as a means of instilling into you the need for careful work and thoughtful arrangement of what you're going to do, then I think it's very important. Certainly for the guy who's going to be a chemist or a chemical engineer. And it probably is of value to the other people, too, in the sense of organizing what you're doing. I mean, just learning how to do things. One could say that quantitative analysis is more of a disciplined activity. But I didn't see it that way. I thought the other was quantitative analysis. By that time, you're sort of semi-pro at least. And I never felt that was a great shucks in molding the chemical activity. The qual was pretty important, I thought. Now, they really ought to go back to it, because we can do it without Kip generators now. In fact, what they ought to really do is have students devise their own schemes based on some kind of program that you can stick in a computer and say, here are the things we want to look for, and here are the characteristics of those things. Devise a scheme. I think that could be done. And that would be a nice creative kind of thing. But the tendency to low rate the lab and get rid of it, I think is wrong. Even for the non-major. We'll come to that when I talk sometime later about science policy. But
yes, I just wanted to throw that part about qual in, since we were talking about it. Were you in discouraged at all by this extensive involvement at that point, or were you encouraged to continue as a chemistry major?
Well, I was never discouraged, but two things, and this is the way it should be in college. My first taste of the geological sciences, my first real taste of philosophy, and my first insight into psychology. And these were fields that I had no knowledge about before. And I really got very interested in all of them. I took 3 years of philosophy, all with Boaz and his assistants. part of one of those years was a course in logic, which I've always thought was not only interesting but useful. I took a couple of years of psychology because back in the late 20s, early 30s, that was a mumbo-jumbo area. Freud was known as a name, but I had a guy named Dunlop who was a very highly thought of psychologist, I find later. In fact, his name still appears 60 years later. He was not a very inspiring lecturer, but for some reason what he said attracted me. And I still have a kind of peripheral interest. I serve on an advisory committee for the Center for Behavioral Science, out in up the hill from Stanford. And I've always had an interest in that. I've always had an interest in geology. I've always had an interest in philosophy. But when the chip was down, roughly in my junior year, I stayed in chemistry. Just possibly because where'd you get a job in these other three things? It wasn't too clear where you get a job in chemistry, but it was better than the others. So the answer is that I was never discouraged about chemistry, but I suddenly saw other things that interested me. I never really got an interest in engineering per se, never got an interest in medical school. That could have happened. With all my friends around here rushing off to medical school, I might have just been aspirated into the same direction. But I took organic chemistry with Emmett Reed.
Oh yes,
Reed's famous name at the time.
Yes,
terrible lecture. mumbled, talked to the board. It was just hard as hell to understand what he was saying. And we used his book. And organic never really impressed me because, at that time it was, you knew the name reactions and you did those things. But I then had a course in F.O. Rice. And I would say that Rice was certainly a prototypical physical organic chemist. I literally took undergraduate organic from Rice. And that was quite different. I was thinking about that last night when he gave his prize to Daring and Roberts. Rice obviously, preceded both of those guys and was not in as good a position to be recognized. But he was a free radical man when free radicals were just Gomberg's free radical, the trimethyl methane. Mm-hmm. And he delved into photo processes. And he looked at energy flows and things. That's very peculiar for 1930s organic chemist. So I got a different insight, but not enough to want to go into the field. And never took a literal course in physical chemistry. Had a laboratory and a lot of separated courses, like X-rays and whatnot, but never an actual physical chemistry course. And I cannot tell you, but I believe that my intention had always been from the time I was taking these high school courses to be a physical chemist. Inorganic, by the way, was not much of a thing. You did chromates and you did so forth, but there was no real coherent field. You're either an organic chemist or an non-organic chemist. And I decided to go into physical.
What was it that attracted you to that area?
Well, I was reasonable in mathematics, not great. That probably kept me from being a physicist. I never thought about being a physicist, but if I wanted to be, I'd have to have been a little more facile with math. I was interested in materials more than forces, but I was interested in the characteristics of the materials rather than the production of the material. So that sort of points you in that direction. Actually, I had a very early interest in colloids and surface chemistry, which is peculiar because colloids is really on its way out, and so I didn't recognize it in the 30s. See, as a senior at Hopkins, and because I had this new plan arrangement, I didn't take a formal physical chemistry course, but I did take as a senior lots of graduate courses. And I had Joe Mayer teaching quantum mechanics and statistical mechanics. Now, this was 1932. Joe Mayer had just come back from Göttingen, where he had either been postdocing or instructing or something like that. Young guy, but recognizable as a real comer. And his wife, who ultimately got a Nobel Prize 20 years later. As in the forefront of a different kind of chemistry, Pauling had already written his book, his freshman book, in the early 30s at least, and had approached chemistry quite different. Smith, I had Alexander Smith, the freshman.
Okay.
Text.
Sure, sure. Okay.
Yeah. Alexander Smith.
Yes.
And the Pauling book I saw some years later, maybe, I was a teaching, they didn't call them teaching assistants then, I forget what they call them. I don't remember, but it was teaching assistants. But as a senior, I had Mayer in quantum and statistical mechanics. No textbook. We had mimeograph notes, which I still have someplace. Hard to read, but I got them. And I took X-ray crystallography to name a lot. And the laboratory, which were a series of experiments that you did yourself. That is, they weren't textbook experiments, but you catalytic decomposition of ammonia, for example, on platinum surface, that kind of thing, where you got experience doing vacuum work, where you got experience with catalysts, where you got experience with following rates, determining orders reaction. So the sort of last formal undergraduate course I had was the organic course that I took from Rice. And looking back, there are actually two undergraduate courses all I had at college, freshman and organic. Never took an analytical course. Never took a formal physical. Hopkins is a very good place to be at the time. I mean, you worked your way through yourself through the educational process, and then you demonstrated that you knew something, as much as they wanted you to know. But as I said, in order to be formally correct, I did plunk down a $10 for a BA diploma in 1932. But I'd already done basically all the coursework for the PhD. And I started working in the laboratory with W.A. Patrick. Patrick was the guy who had the silica gel patents, which I think he handed off to, what's the name of it? Baltimore Chemical Company. If Grace owns them now, but I forget. Davidson Chemical Company. And Davidson made soda gel for many years. They were the main purveyors of it. But I started the work in Patrick's lab in my first year, right in my transition from getting the bachelor's degree, and took only a few formal courses, sort of now and then, nothing too formal. Of course, with Noyes and Cheryl. You remember Noyes and Cheryl? Course in thermodynamics from Don Landry's. I had an organic course with Reed, which is where I learned that I didn't know what the hell he was talking about. Couldn't understand it. That's all, I guess. From that point on, it was all laboratory work. At Hopkins, they at that time, what they did was go around to pick four laboratories and work in it for a couple months each in the first year. And it was on the basis of that you decided where you wanted to do your PhD.
What were the others? I was going to ask you how you selected Patrick. What were the other laboratories that you spent some time
in? Well, I went into the crystallographic laboratory, the X-ray laboratory. I went into Reed's laboratory. I went into the laboratory of a guy named Fraser, who was a catalyst chemist. And I went to Patrick's. In Reed's laboratory, I did, he was writing a book on sulfur chemistry. And I prepared a lot of thioethers and
really?
Man, I stunk. I gotta tell you, I could get on a streetcar and get a seat with no trouble. I did that for several months. The one lab accident I had was in Reed's lab. I was doing a Grignard, and I can't remember why I was doing it. But I was adding formaldehyde to Grignard reagent. And this was early enough in the game that we used soft glass. And I remember the formaldehyde, the paraformaldehyde was in a three neck flask. And I came out of one of the necks with a U tube. It wasn't actually a U tube, it was two pieces of tubing with holes blown in, and a cross piece fused into those holes, and these are soft glass, so that, you know, that it was tenuous, and the horizontal piece was wrapped with nichrome just out in the open, no asbestos, nothing on it, with battery clips holding it to wires that came out of the plug. I guess it had a rheostat so you could adjust. Anyway, I had the paraformaldehyde being heated, and we weren't heating over electric systems, we were heating over gas. And I had corks in the tops of these two vertical tubes, rubber stoppers, not corks. And the damn thing had plugged, you know. If it sublimed and got caught in the middle someplace. And nothing was happening in the Grignard where the store was. I went to look over the top to see where the plug was, and the thing blew out, and I caught this formaldehyde up my nose. I mean, it was a heavy dose. I had a devil of a time catching my breath. I hung out the window about an hour, but I didn't. But I had it selectively damaged my odor sensors. For example, I can't detect house gas. I can't smell skunks. But some things, certain perfumes, are accentuated. I sometimes get in the cab with the cab driver, it's got a little bit of something on, I gotta get out. So, but unfortunately, that was the extent of my accident in life. It also decided me against being an organic chemist. I think that was a straw. And anyway, I did that lab. I did the X-ray lab. And that wasn't bad. Back then, the X-ray labs, you know what you did? You packed that fallopian tube with powder and put it down in the middle of this circular camera. And we actually had an ion tube rather than an electron tube. And you had to stopcock it. You had to crack properly in order to maintain a proper vacuum. And you also had to center this camera on the exit tube, X-ray tube. You do that by reaching around a ledge shield that's out there. And you sort of fiddle with it, get lined up. You had a zinc sulfide, you had a phosphor sitting back here, and you looked to get it straight. Well, these two fingers began to, just the ends of these two fingers began to show burns. You know, you're in that X-ray scatter all the time. People didn't worry about it for a while. But they began to show burns. And I decided I wasn't going to do that one. So I got rid of two of them. Catalyst thing was all right, but it was really very, very rote. Fraser had been instrumental in producing hoptolite. Hoptolite was a mixed chromium, manganese, cobalt, maybe iron, four or five oxides used in coal mines for the CO problem. Lots of that CO, CO2. But it seemed like an awfully routine kind of thing. You prepare a lot of stuff, you precipitate all these things, you co-precipitate them, you know, dry them, get a standard catalytic oxidation, and go back and do it again. So I didn't particularly like that. But Patrick's lab, first we prepared silica gel, and then I got interested in a couple of things. One of them was to measure the zeta potential of the silica gel, for which I devised a scheme of trying to set the gel around an electrode, around a silver chloride electrode, which is a nice, interesting trick in itself. And we got along pretty well. I did a lot of work in that. Decided then to prepare the silica as the electrode is such that you could move water through the gel and you could measure the zeta potential by that rate of motion. And I decided to do it on an electrophoresis tube, a U-tube, in which you suspended the silica gel and watched the motion. It was an interesting thing. In fact, I pretty much had completed it when Patrick said he had an interesting problem he wondered if I'd work on, which was to try to determine the molecular composition of sulfur monochloride dissolved in various solvents. You ever worked with sulfur monochloride?
No, but I read your paper, and it...
Man, that's terrible. That's terrible stuff. If I knew before what I knew just after, I would never have done it. But did it by Cottrell method. Had two Cottrell flasks and just did the differential temperature measurement. One with the salt boiling solvent and one with the solution. And from the boiling point rise and the nominal composition solution, you could determine how much polymerization there was in solution. Patrick had been interested in it because he thought he had a way of refining gasoline using sulfur monochloride. And this information was interesting, but it turned out you just couldn't handle large quantities of S2Cl2. Even then, I knew enough to wear goggles because that stuff got in your eyes. Some kind of protein coagulation took place that, you know, sort of the end of your eye. But it was an interesting piece of work because I had to work with a somewhat more elaborate apparatus than I had been up to that time. I had a Julia suspension which permitted me to put a galvanometer inside of a air bath, inside of a water bath, so I could maintain. In other words, it's a very, very precise measurement of a delta T. And because by the time December 1934 rolled around, I was further along on this one than I was on the silica gel problem. We used that for the dissertation. But that really was not my interest. I went back to surface chemistry.
You never published anything on the silica gel?
No, I didn't get far enough for publication. See, there's something else about that. So I remember that was about the time that the microelectrophoresis tubes were designed, you know, the kind where you put a single particle on a microscope stage and follow the movement of that particle on the potential gradient. And that seemed to me to be eminently more suitable than this gross method I used, which was a U-tube and a suspension. And I thought that was further along, so I just didn't get back to it. I actually got interested. I stayed around Hopkins for a year at the 35. In fact, even guys like Joe Mayer had to look for ways to make enough money to stay viable during the Depression. So he took a freshman teaching job at Hopkins. But he didn't know any freshman chemistry. I mean, he was a very bright guy. Quantum mechanics he knew. But he didn't know about precipitating iron sulfide or how you determine chromium or any of that kind of stuff. So he asked me to be his teaching assistant or whatever they call them, the laboratory guy. So I ran his laboratory for a year and stayed around Hopkins for an additional year, kept my lab, and got interested in the fuel cell. No, that's not right. Got interested in the oxygen electrode. And if I knew how I got interested in it, I'd tell you, but I don't. But it annoyed me that it was irreversible. I sort of decided I was going to find out why. And it's now 4 years later, and I still don't know why. But anyway, I'd spent a year trying to develop a reversible oxygen electrode, and did some interesting stuff. That's where I got interested in electrochemistry. Did some interesting work, and indeed, if you neglect the difference in temperature between room temperature and high temperature fuel cells, 1,000 degrees centigrade, I was doing that kind of work back in 1936 and didn't know it, because that's the kind of anode they use now. I use graphite, very pure graphite rod, and I don't remember the solution anymore, but I was trying to get an oxygen electrode which would approach reversibility if I could raise the temperature, or if I change the temperature. I didn't know whether to go high or low, so I scanned it. That's what I did during that year, and that was not publishable either, so I didn't. But I did get interested in the oxygen electrode then, and that gave me an interest in the fuel cell later on.
You said at the time jobs were very hard to find. Before we go to that, how was Hopkins faring through this part of the Depression?
Well, they were bankrupt. Not in the current sense, but they couldn't pay their bills in 32 and 33. And I guess people didn't know what you did with the school, but the university couldn't pay its bills. So they probably carried them. And they say the faculty wasn't getting paid either. And some of the very good ones had to leave. See, Hopkins had a first-rate chemistry department. When I came there as an undergraduate, Urey was there. This fellow Ott went on to become the director of research at up in Wilmington, not DuPont. What else is up there?
Hercules.
Hercules, yeah. Emmett was there. Emmett's the guy with Brunauer and Teller that
Paul
Paul Emmett,
yes.
Mm-hmm. He was there. He had to leave. He came back, but he had to leave at that time. Maurice Huggins was there. He went up, I think, to Rochester, someplace like that. Dave, an outstanding X-ray crystallographer who went to GE. Dave is his first name. I can't remember his last name. Had a whole lot of first-rate people that had to go. They just couldn't afford to hold on to them. Guys like Reed State, he was actually retired sometime in that general period. Patrick State, he apparently was independently wealthy, well off, not wealthy, from his silica gel patents. Fraser stayed because he was within a few years. And the small there's a guy named Thornton there. Neil Gordon of the Gordon Conferences was there.
Sure.
But he went off, incidentally, in about 34 or 5, went to Center College. So the university had a tough, now I don't know about the other departments, I'm sure they had the same kind of problems. The university had a very tough time. And it had to exist on its cash flow, have any endowment that was functional. But it managed to get along. It's hard to see how it did it, seeing how it works now. If you want to do an experiment, you have to root around the place to find the stuff to do it with. And you didn't go to a catalog. I think somebody was saying yesterday $200. Well, $200 was hard to come by. You didn't have $200. I can remember making my own relays, mechanical relays. So you get a wooden spool off that somebody used to sew with, mm-hmm. cotton, mm-hmm. and you wind some, and you go find an old rheostat and wind some wire, take that wire and wind it on this thing, and get a piece of soft iron. I mean, the whole business.
What about chemical?
Well, it's a little hard for me to remember, but I'm sure that all the chemicals we used came out of a central storeroom, and probably used to put spatulas into the bottling and get out what we needed. In my case, the chemicals were fairly simple, except when I was doing this sulfur chemistry for Reed, and he supplied it. I don't know how he got it. But in my own lab, basically distilled water and either salts or some acids or something like that. It wasn't a great problem. At least I don't remember it as a problem. But the equipment I do remember is a problem. I remember spending weeks building thermostats. Finding a box, making sure that the insulation was good in it. Then rooting around the cellar and getting a stir and finding a bracket so I could put the stir on. Made my own thermal regulators. You get some glass and a bulb, then a capillary tube. You go look around for capillary tubing and then put under a microscope and hope that you had a uniform tube, you know. Seal that on top here and then find a thimble or something that you could use as a cap, put a tungsten, weld a tungsten wire into it, and the thermostat, I mean the regulator was obviously the expansion of mercury, and then you calibrated that against a reasonably good thermometer. They did have good thermometers around, I'll say that, precise thermometer. So you'd spend literally 10 days building this thing. And that's the reason it took a year to do something at the time. Now, of course, you buy it. Takes 6 weeks to get it from the supplier.
Given the state of the time, as you said, you had applied earlier. You said you had applied to Ohio State and found there were 1,000 others. What about industrial positions? Were you looking at?
Well,
they were probably scarce too.
They were very scarce. There was a fairly good connection with DuPont. They would send people down from Willing, but I never got an offer from them. I think there were probably one or two other industrial outfits, but I got to tell you, in 1934 there were about 20 to 25 PhDs at Hopkins. And I may have 33 and 34 confused, I'm not sure. But nobody in that group got a job. And I can well remember seeing them in one of the larger laboratories in the building on a PWA project. And the PWA project was to make hoplite, you know, in as many different ways as you could. And each of these guys were, you know how these desks are. There'd be three guys at this desk, three at this one, and there were about 20 of them. And they had these large, ungraduated cylinders, about that big, and maybe 3 inches in diameter. And you'd go in there, they'd have a long stirring rod. They'd be stirring, every one of these guys would be stirring the stuff, and there'd be purple and green and blue stuff precipitating, you know, in different forms. None of them had jobs. The year I graduated, there were about 20 of us. Hopkins had a good plan. This new plan not only involved people locally that could go, or people locally, but anybody who could be admitted could finish in 6 years. And it came from all over the country. They came from all over the country because somebody, and I think it might have been Gordon, had developed a scheme which involved getting industry to put out money for fellowships, which were geographical. In other words, it'd be one from the Northeast, one from Utah, one from down here, for example. And the class or the group that got together to get PhDs in 35, the ones I went with, most of them took 4 years, I took three, were from all over the country, literally. And when we finished, most of those guys disappeared. They went back to the regions they came from. The half a dozen or so of us who were local, none of them got jobs except me. I got a job at Loyola teaching in physical chemistry laboratories. And I had this job with Joe Mayer I was telling you about. And between the two of them, I guess I was making $1,300 or $1,400 a year, something like that. Then a guy came to me. Well, I had already started doing a little consulting. That's kind of interesting. It just occurred to me. Somebody came to Patrick and said they'd like him to do a particle size distribution and a characterization on a clay, which they thought was bentonite. And I presume that meant they'd found a deposit and they wanted to know whether it was worth trying to mine. And Patrick, as I said, was at least well off, if nothing else. And he turned to me and asked me if I wanted to do it. Since I wasn't doing anything, I said yes, which meant I learned how to do particle size distribution. We got a settling tube, which was a vertical tube with at the bottom, almost V-shaped piece that came off, was bent, and then had a nearly horizontal segment to it. And what you do is put the suspension in the large tube. The bypass tube came off a small distance from the bottom. You put the suspension in the large tube, and it supported a column, which you amplified by this nearly horizontal piece. And as that stuff settled out, its density decreased, its average density decreased, and the meniscus moved back, and you could read the rate at which it moved, and from that you could do a distribution of the settling curve. So I did that, and I guess it took an hour to make the tube and set it up, another hour to do the experiment, and did it a couple times, I'm sure. And I came back to see Patrick later that day and said, here, I've got the settling curve and distribution curve. He said, that's fine. Send it to so-and-so and send him a bill along with it. I said, good, I'll make $25. And he said, no, you know, if you do that, they're going to think it's not worth anything because you're not charging them enough, very much. Charge them $200. So I did. They wrote back, thanked me for the information, sent me the check. I learned a very valuable lesson from it. Don't underrate the value. But because of that, I think because of that, the next time somebody came, he sent them to me again. And this was a man who currently would be called a venture capitalist. That is, he himself was not technically oriented. He had some money. And he went around looking for things that he could invest in. He was a guy who had invested in what was then called no belt. You know, this elastic thing that that they have in slacks, that kind of thing. This guy had already done that, so he made some dough. It was about 1936. And what he had was a device in which he produced suspensions, or in which, not he, but suspensions or emulsions could be produced that were fairly stable. And he was interested in using this on a commercial scale, but he didn't quite know what he was talking about. His name was Mr. Hardy, Harry Hardy. And he came to me, Patrick referred him, he came to me to find out what this stuff might be good for. Well, it occurred to me that there were a number of things. For example, one of the things that at that time on the grocer shelf, if you were to make a salad dressing, like a French dressing, and you put it on the shelf, in a very short period of time, it separate. And that was undesirable. Even if you try to disguise it with a color, you'd still see it. Also at that time, before your time probably, when you got a bottle of milk, you could see the cream layer on the top. And so I said to him, look, if one could homogenize that milk, you'd form a material that would be easier to sell it to me. And that, so, well, that's fine. That's what he wanted to know. So when I came back later, and he had undertaken the deal with whoever this inventor was, and asked if I would help develop the use of this machine, and that he would pay me $35 a week and give me some stock. I can't remember how much stock. I had one of my friends there, the only friend that, only one who got his PhD the same time I did, who was already married and he already had a kid. All the rest of us were bachelors. No, that's not true. There was one woman. All the rest of us were unmarried. And I thought this guy deserved some help, so we split the job, he and I. Each got 17 and a half bucks, and each got whatever the stock was. The system was a hell of a system. There was an electromagnet which operated a heavy piece 3,600 times. Yeah, it's all 60 cycle. About 3,600 times a minute. It was a hardened piece of steel, which was a kind of an electric hammer, magnetic hammer. And into the hole of that hammer, you put another rod, and that rod would have on its bottom some plates. The plates were made of nickel, usually, or chrome nickel. And you could vary the thickness of the plates, couldn't vary the diameter, except smaller, you could make them big. And they were fitted on a rod and tightened and so on. And the point was that this was a high-speed churn, for one thing, but also you got vibration, you got the natural frequency vibration in the nickel plates. And finally also, because you could make the clearance pretty close, you got a, what do you call that action? You got this squeeze right at the edge. All three of those things did the same thing. That is, they helped you disperse material. So this other fellow and I took the basic design, built a glass system, and began to make emulsions. Horrendous noise, you know, in a room this size with that hammer going. We learned early to wear ear pieces. Anyway, we made good homogenized milk right away. The problem was, and we did this in 1930, just finished about 1937, we told Hardy that we had the stuff they wanted. The problem was the submarine signal company at about that time was also looking for homogenized milk. And they developed a system in which they acoustically disturb a plate of nickel and ran the milk down over it, and it was a lot easier than our system. So we lost that one. And homogenized milk, you see, began to appear in 1937-38, not before that. So there were two or three processes in the works. We also did this other thing. I told you about the salad dressing. Well, it occurred to me that the way to make that thing, suspend that thing, the oil and vinegar, was to put carbon black in as a Pickering emulsifier. And then we made a very stable oil and vinegar emulsion with this material. And Hardy was all excited, and I was all excited, and took it home to his wife, and she said, "Ick, she wouldn't use a black salad dressing." And it was black, you know, as black as that thing.
Sure.
But stable. And I try to point out to her that the carbon black probably do her some good, just the process of some good. So. But we lost that one, too. Anyway, we lost them all, finally. We did, for example, we did bismuth subsalicylate, which was used for treatments of syphilis. And these are needle-like crystals, and they injected into the patient, and they'd have terrible pains where the large particles collected. Well, we broke that stuff up pretty good, and had it developed, and the people at Hopkins Hospital were very interested in it because it certainly diminished the pain problem. But they developed a better way of treating syphilis. So we were behind the curve all the way, and it finally folded in about 1939. And all we got out of the stock was, I held it for 10 years and took it off in income tax.
That what was called the Colloid Corporation?
That was a Colloid Corporation, yeah.
I was interested in how that...
Yeah. That,
so you were involved with this. You were also teaching at Loyola.
And looking for another job.
At Loyola, was it just freshman chemistry or laboratory?
No, I just did physical chemistry lab.
Okay, just the phys chem lab.
And there were 8 or 10 or 12 people there. It was very nice. I enjoyed it. They were pretty good students. I was often amazed at the groaning board that they set up for the faculty with all drinks and all the rest of it. But it was purely stopgap. I didn't. You have to be a Jesuit to be on the faculty. In fact, the guy who taught the course was a Jesuit priest, Father Schmidt. And obviously, that was a dead end for me. So I was stopgap.
Were you still looking through all this time? Were you still actively looking for another position?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I was not married at the time. I didn't get married until 1940. But the lady was to be my wife would type letters for me constantly. I sent 400 or 500 letters worldwide to universities, even to the University of Witwatersrand in South Africa, where I got turned down too. Nothing but turned down. But and the ACS started its clearinghouse somewhere in that general period of the second part of the 30s, because there were a lot of people looking for jobs. That was a pretty good deal, employment clearinghouse. And they also had a lot, ads that I would follow. And I spent a lot of time, not a lot of time, but I spent time in Washington, which is only 40 miles away. Only is not a proper adjective, but it was 40 miles away. And I could get over there. I was particularly interested in trying to get into one of the regional laboratories of the Department of Agriculture, which was set up by an act in about 36 or 37. And these were four labs, you may know them, Albany, Oregon, someplace in Louisiana, someplace in Illinois. There were four of them around the country. And they were to do basic research as well as more applied agricultural research. And so I went over there and camped out in the Department of Agriculture a lot, trying to get a job in one of those places. Some of my friends who had graduated with me had finally got what were called P1s with the government, professional grade one. They were shrimp inspectors in Biloxi, Mississippi. Three of them went down there. And the pay was, I think, $2,600 a year, something like that. A couple of others had got jobs with paint companies in Baltimore. There were a half a dozen paint companies, and they became chemists. They do analyses on incoming stuff, you know, and they demonstrated how well they were putting stuff together. I went over there and tried to get one of those DA jobs. Struck out. I didn't have agricultural experience, or they didn't want physical chemist, or whatever it was. I didn't get it. But while I was there, I learned other procedures. And I began to take these. They gave tests for these professional jobs on occasions. And I would take them. And what you did was take them to get on a list. And then if somebody wanted a P1 or P2 or whatever, they'd look at that list and then like you if they wanted it. So I got a, I don't know if it was by call or letter, I got an invitation from the U.S. Coast Guard on a P1 job at Staten Island. The Coast Guard had just taken over the White House, right? I don't remember the title, but it was the federal outfit that handled light ships and did buoys and things, you know, in the various waterways. And the Coast Guard was just getting jurisdiction for that in about 1939, I think. And the White House Service, that's what it was called, the White House Service had a laboratory at St. George on Staten Island. St. George is where this ferry, Staten Island Ferry, comes in. And right alongside of that ferry slip is where this White House thing was. There was a dock, and there were buoys on it, and parts for light ships and lighthouses. And a two-story building. And the top story was a chemistry laboratory, cunningly hidden, so to speak. And I went there and took that job. It was $2,000 a year. It was a P1 rating. And my job was to do a bunch of analyses as needed. There was another fellow already there by the name of Ryle Bailey, R-Y-E-L Bailey, who was a BS chemist out of Iowa. And who had been in federal service. Now, how he got to this place, I don't know, but he had been in federal service most of his life. I thought he was a pretty old guy. He was 45, maybe. I was 25. And we did analysis on brass, on hemp, on paint, white paint, great deck paint, all kinds of paint, and other things of that general nature. The interesting thing was that the Coast Guard had never had a laboratory before. And I can remember a paint sample coming in from some company. And I took a piece out of, took a sample out of it and did the various analysis. You know, you swing off this, the pigment, see how much pigment's in there, and you analyze the pigment, see what, how much barium sulfate there is, how much calcium carbonate. So, then you do the vehicle. See, at that time, they were just getting ready to, just getting into synthetic vehicles, contrasted linseed oil. And I finished the analysis and wrote on the report that this stuff didn't come up to specification, gave it to Bailey. And he sent it over to the captain, Coast Guard captain over in Brooklyn, where the office was. He gave it to the company, and the company looked surprised, apparently. Took the shipment, and about 3 days later, brought another one in. They sent it to me, and it was the same damn stuff. All they do is move it off the site. And I said, you know, I rejected it. This time the captain and some irate guy from the paint company came over to see us. And the irate guy became unirate when he saw we had a laboratory. He didn't know that there was a lab testing this stuff, because it had just moved over from the Lighthouse Service. And this time he sent in a good sample, because apparently three times and out, you have to pay triple damages or something. So he sent in a good sample. Anyway, this was an analytical laboratory. It was interesting for a few months, because I learned some analyses. I learned some physical tests on wire and rope and that kind of thing. But it certainly wasn't what I wanted to do. There had been an ACS meeting. The ACS meeting was in New York. And I went up to the Employment Clearinghouse. It was at the Pennsylvania Hotel, you know, right across from the old Grand Central, not Grand Central, but
Penn Station,
on 33rd Street and 7th Avenue, I guess. And one of the outfits I had already written to, that was at that Employment Clearinghouse, the University of Texas. And another one was TVA. And they both had openings. TVA had an opening for P2 or 3 or something like that. It wasn't civil service, but the equivalent of P3, two grades above where I was. And turned out I got offers from both of those. So the question was whether to go to Tennessee or go to Texas. And Tennessee was pretty far. Texas was terribly far. But my wife said, go to Texas, so we did. It was a damn good choice.
Somewhere in here, I thought that okay. What about VPI?
Oh, I missed that. Not for that. You're right. I'm wrong.
Okay, I just wanted to get the sequence.
Let me see, how did I get the VPI job? I went from the Coast Guard to VPI. That is correct. And I got the VPI in the fall of, must have been 41.
Before the war started.
Before the war started. Yeah, that visit with it in New York was later. How did I get the VPI? Okay, the New York, the Texas thing was done differently. The VPI thing was like this. I went to the clearinghouse, and the job was at VPI, not at Texas. See, I got married in August of 1940. I'd been working at the Coast Guard from the year before, and I stayed at the Coast Guard until the summer, the end of the summer, 1940. So I was at the Coast Guard about a year and three quarters. Half of that time, I was unmarried, but in the boarding house up in St. George. The other half, I got married, and we lived in a place called Richmond on Staten Island. Okay, my wife worked at Columbia. And I got this VPI job through the clearinghouse, and we went down there in September 1941. That was it. And the job was the Texas thing was very far off, that's right. The job was an assistant professorship in chemistry, and my principal duties would be to do the physical chemistry laboratory under a fellow named Scherer, who was lecturing, and as much freshman chemistry as they needed done in whatever semester it was. Yeah. And I took it without too much consideration because I wanted to get out of this routine analytical job. I'd done each of the analyses once, and that was enough. When I got down to Blacksburg, it was a very nice place. I don't know if you've ever been there. Small, very small town. This was one of the essentially military colleges, ROTC. One of the first things that bothered me when I talked to the department chairman, Dr. Watson, I said, what about the chances of getting a little bit of money to do some research? And he said, in this state, the research is done at Charlottesville. I hadn't been smart enough to ask that question before. Well, as it turns out, there was research going on there. Scherer was doing some research in both natural and artificial filaments. And when I asked about that, I was told that was different. I mean, he had a deal. I found a kindred spirit in the faculty, a fellow who was an associate professor. I came as an assistant professor, had tenure, and he said that he does research there, but nobody knows about it. He does it up on the top floor where nobody watches him, and that I was welcome to come up and use the lab. And it turned out we were both interested in sort of the same thing. I got interested in corrosion at the Coast Guard, and he had some deterioration interests, whether it's metals or non-metals. So we did a little bit of work together. Now the war broke out 3 months later, and the nature of the place changed a bit. For example, while I was still getting doing the physical chemistry lab, I was also doing at least three freshman lecture courses. And then toward the end of that year, end of 41-42, the Army had developed a program known as the ASTP, the Army Specialized Training Program. And the Army Specialized Training Program was to identify soldiers who could gain by being more highly educated, but in turn the Army could gain by using their increased qualification. And they sent us eight soldiers from different places. And one of the things I was to do was to work with these eight guys. They had varying degrees of experience in chemistry. They were all college types, that is, either were going or had been going or could have gone. And I spent a lot of time that first year finding courses for them and developing activities for them. Incidentally, of those eight, I think five got PhDs ultimately, you know, after everything was over. And that was a very interesting period. But the following year, that's 42-43, I think that's the right sequence. The army, the company commanders had learned that, hey, here was a place they could get rid of their malcontents. So instead of sending the good guys, they sent the bad guys. And their bad guys came to us in large numbers. And I now had to give freshman chemistry, a two-hour freshman chemistry course, seven times. Repeated seven times during the week. 14 hours of those classes. And these were not guys who were interested. I mean, these were pretty restless fellows. So that was not very nice. I didn't really appreciate that. And obviously, there was no time to do anything else, do any research. It was clearly out of the window. And so I enlisted in the Navy and was offered a commission as an ensign. And I went up to Baltimore to take a physical exam. Took a physical exam and passed that all right, and received orders to report to Cornell to gunnery school, which I thought was pretty peculiar. I'd never fired a gun in my life, rifle or pistol or anything else. But and I forget what the date was, but someday. But I got a call from a guy, and I think this is right now, I'm not certain. I got the call from this guy or somebody else, I'm not certain. But I got a call from a guy named Zola Deutsch in New York, who told me that I was to report to the Woolworth building instead of going to Cornell for non-Navy duty. And I hadn't the slightest idea how they knew about me or anything else. And I went up there, and it was to work in the Manhattan District Project. Mm. This was late 43, maybe. To work with Deutsch and a guy named Lunum and a woman whose name was Kelly, secretary, and myself. And we were the materials group of the Manhattan District Project, specifically for the K-25 portion. And it was my job to go to various laboratories, primarily in and around New York, but also further out. Watch what was, establish some contacts, watch what was going on, not tell anybody from one to the other, but just see whether there was excessive duplication, whether the duplication was useful, etc. And follow the course of the research we were doing, which was predominantly, in this case, the detrimental effects on nickel of a variety of materials. These were fluorine-containing materials, predominantly. And I had to go, in fact, that was my first trip to Cleveland. I had to go to Horshaw. Mm-hmm. By chemical problem, and to a Chrysler plant that was making tanks. I don't mean military tanks, but tanks to hold the bundles of diffusers that were going into the K-25 plant, made out of molten nickel powder. So I did a lot of traveling in that area. That was not Detroit. It was, might have been Cleveland too, I'm not sure now. At any rate, then Oak Ridge was another place I had to go to. Princeton, Bell Telephone Labs, the SAM Laboratories, which was a old Nash dealer building north of Columbia, and the Columbia itself. And that's what I did for about a year. I had to move away from my wife. We had a kid at that time. They stayed in Virginia, and I went to New York. I lived in Y on 63rd Street, right out, like, just west of Central Park. And it was at that time, in the fall of 44, that the ACS had its meeting in New York. And I met with Drs. Henze and Williams of the UT. And I must have made the contact by answering an ad. I don't have any other idea how I did it. And I got the offer from both TVA and Texas at the same time. And we decided to go to Texas.
Any particular overriding reasons? One was academic, the other was a government type of installation.
That's right. The government installation, or quasi-government installation, was a lot safer. That is, the job, as long as I didn't screw it up good, was permanent. And the other was a tenure track. I had to do something in 4 or 5 years. As I said, I asked my wife where she would rather be, and she said Texas, so we went to Texas. And with some opposition from family and friends, they thought, going to get scalped down there.
Did you come out here to visit before you made the decision, or did you do
no,
it?
No, I came down on a trip in October, roughly, of 1944. By train. Couldn't get on an airplane then. Airplanes took a long time anyway, they were DC-3s. Train was an overnight train through St. Louis, you know. 2 days in the night. And I got to the Austin campus on the day that they fired the president. So they weren't really very interested in talking to me. But I did look first this time at did they permit research, not did they support it. And yeah, there were about 19 or 20 people on the faculty, and 2/3 of them were very active. Not in the current sense of active, mm-hmm. but they had laboratories, they had graduate students. They gave PhDs, as a matter of fact. At VPI, they didn't at that time. And so I looked at that, and that was first. And what was the load? Well, we try to cut it to 3 classes a semester, so it's just 9 hours. Well, I've been used to 12 and 14. That was no problem. It was a nice place. October, a day like this, you know. And aside from the fact there was some turmoil, which didn't seem to bother, you know, I wasn't bothered. I didn't deal with presidents. They weren't my problem. And my wife, she makes these judgments on it once in a while. Said, go here, so we went there. Turned out very well. Can't guarantee it wouldn't have.
Good morning.
Hi.
Hello.
Hello.
Excuse me.
You said a little bit about 20 faculty, people who were active, at least had graduate students, and so on. Did you start teaching introductory chemistry right away, or did that come later?
At Texas? Mm-hmm. No, I taught one or more sections of freshman chemistry and a course in colloid chemistry, predominantly for chemical engineers. It was required for chemical engineers. And I would have probably two of the freshman classes and the colloid class one semester, and two of the freshman classes and probably a section of physical chemistry in the other semester. That's where I started. The freshman classes would be two lecture hours and a recitation section. And at that time, oversight of the lab, because it was associated with that section. And the recitation section, I'd have one of the recitation sections, and then the others would be other faculty members and some of our senior teaching fellows. In the labs, I would have teaching assistants. I would say there'd be 200 to the class. That would mean there'd be about eight lab sections. Labs once a week, 4 hours. I think that's right. The colloid course, there were 40 people. I had a teaching assistant, and it had a lab. There were three lecture hours a week, and then maybe a four-hour laboratory, just like a physical chemistry. It was a very fine course in the sense that the people that sometimes come up to me in airports and so forth, say, "Hey, I had this class, that class, the other class." The ones that are most vigorous in their approval are the ones that took colloids. Now, these are older people because the colloid requirement was dropped from the chemical engineering curriculum probably in 1955. So for 10 years I gave it.
Was that standard in the chemical engineering curriculum to have a colloid course?
No.
Course, or was that unique to...
It was certainly not usual. Unique, I'm not sure. But it was based on two guys in chemical engineering, a fellow named Schock and a fellow named Nobi. And these two people insisted that it be a requirement because they recognized that one of the things that their chemical engineers came up against in plant operations and in the development work that goes on around industrial plants are colloid type materials. Well, it's just loaded with them. And that's the reason that these guys come up and say they're glad they took it, because they were prepared for the kind of things that they were going to see in their reactors. And emulsion formation, emulsion breaking, suspension movement, things of that sort. They don't do it now. I mean, they stopped doing it in 1955 because they began to introduce this more quantitative modeling systems. And they had to move something to do it, so they moved something that was not in their own course. Both Schock and Nobi died, and that was the end of it. That was the thing that went. But it was a good course, and when that went, I replaced it with a graduate course in surface and interfacial chemistry, which included some of that. And then another graduate course in electrochemistry, which I alternated. By the time that came into being, though, we were down to two classes a semester instead of three. So I would give a freshman class and an advanced class. In fact, I gave a freshman class the whole time I was at Texas, every year, every semester. And I gave freshman classes at Rice for a while, until I had to be away too much. And I couldn't quite make it.
Well, I want to come back to that in our next session, but yeah. You had that earlier, you had a very early paper on the equilibrium concept and way it was being taught or suggestions about it. So that was 46, right after you got
there. Right after I got there.
So you obviously were involved in pedagogy and teaching the introductory courses.
Well, we'll get to it later, but I believe that's as important a thing as I've done. As you said, we'll talk about it when I get to science policy.
Okay.
All right.
Fine. Your interest in corrosion carried over, obviously, right to the beginning when you started.
Yeah. My interest in corrosion was, sort of augmented by the work I did the Manhattan District project.
It started in the Coast Guard.
Started in Coast Guard, and I was brought in, as it turns out, because of deterioration materials problems, and the concern of what would happen in the K-25 plant if fluorine got loose. Not got loose, but got started on something. The real worry was that a workman would leave his overalls or his glove inside, and when we flushed it with fluorine. There was another worry, and one that was more real, I think. Not that the guy might not leave his glove inside, but it was hard to predetermine what would happen with moisture if moisture got into the system. And to that end, it was my job in this wandering around the laboratories or doing the work was to infect the minds of some people to carry out experiments, not to tell them, because the instruction was don't say nothing, but get them to do this. To infect them to the point they would do experiments that would involve the simultaneous injection of water vapor and fluorine under the conditions that were considered to be the problems, and to determine what the effect would be on a couple of things. See, there was not only the problem of an accidental burn, but these tubes, they must have been 15 feet long. They were just nickel powder pressed together, and they were porous. They had to be porous. They didn't have a whole lot of structural strength, but also you couldn't tolerate the growth of nickel fluoride into those pores, or you wouldn't get diffusion. And this process depended on U-235F6 and U-238F6 and U-239F6. And we wanted the U-235 to come through and be concentrated. These were cascaded. There were great bundles of these tubes in the tank, and then the tanks were in cascades, and you'd run them downstream. The stuff inside would go one way and the stuff outside would go another way. But if it didn't get outside, it wouldn't do you much good. I don't know if you've ever seen that K-25 plant at Oak Ridge. But
I've seen pictures, probably.
It's a huge place. I mean, it's big is big, but this is huge. And it's just a whole bunch of these things, one after another. And the concentration, I even forget the factor, so I can't tell to you. But the concentrations are great in each bundle of tubes. And if they didn't concentrate here, then there's no point in sending them to the next one. So there was a worry about what would happen if the nickel corroded. And say the hydrated fluoride had a bigger volume than the nickel that it displaced. Well, what would happen is you drop the porosity. So we had to get these experiments done and do them independently, and then I compared them so that the reproducibility was really pretty clean. I mean, Joe Blow here didn't know that Minnie Moe was doing the same thing. So when we got results that were comparable, that we were pretty comfortable with. At any rate, that was the corrosion problem, you see. Corrosion is not just red iron oxide. It's a variety of things. When I got to Austin, I'd done that little bit of work at VPI and also at the Manhattan District Project. And I was interested in it. It was the easiest thing to set up. By that time, corrosion was sort of a little different. It had electrochemical aspects where electrolytes were involved. And the whole thing was buttressed by the fact that shortly after I got to Austin, I wish I could say specifically what part of the year, but sometime in that first year, not too far into that first year, I was visited by a fellow by the name of Tom Bacon, who was employed by the Lone Star Gas Company in Dallas. How he got to know about me, I have no idea. But he said that there was a field in east of Dallas, the Opelika field, in which they were having peculiar difficulties with a couple of wells. And he wondered if I would be willing to take a look at it. And that was my second consulting job. The first one was a suspension business. And I said yes without really knowing what was going on, but they took me out in the field, and what was happening is that they had two wells side by side. They had the same name, Tullis number one, Tullis number two, and they assumed that they were producing the same fluids. These were condensate wells, and one of them was corroding badly and the other one wasn't, and he wondered if I could help him find out what was going on. Well, I approached it in a fairly straightforward way. I got him to insert some steel coupons into the flow system and then took a look at those. And it was fairly clear to me that there were considerable differences in the two fluids. And when they went back and looked, they found they were producing from different horizons. So the fact they were sitting cheek by jowl had nothing to do with it. It was where the hole was. But they were impressed by the quick response. So then the question was, what about this one that was corroding? What could they do about it? And I established that the Tullis number two had a fluid in which there was material that acted as an inhibitor. Very natural inhibitor. The composition of liquids were fairly much the same. In other words, they both should have corroded, but one had something else in it. And there was a guy named Lochte on the faculty there, organic chemist, who knew a fair amount about petroleum composition. And we came to a conclusion that there were naphthenic acids in the one which was not corroded badly. I suggested to them they take the flow of one and run it back up through the other. They wouldn't do that, but that would have done it for them. But I got interested in inhibitors. You know, I was impressed by the fact that yes, some millimolar amounts of materials could make that much difference. And my interfacial chemistry background, you know, explain why. You don't need a lot to cover a surface. Relatively, you don't need much. That got me interested in inhibitors as a research area, and that's where I got started on. So I was interested in inhibitors. I'd been interested in that oxygen lecture I told you earlier. That got me interested in passivity. So the two main thrusts that I had were, how do inhibitors function, and what is this thing called passivity?
You also had
The Corrosion Research Laboratory, did you start that?
Yeah.
How did that come about? Was that for funding purposes? To? I have a date here, 1948, so you were only there a short time.
Yeah. The first fellow that I had working with me, he came to get a graduate degree, had been employed at the International Chemical Company's magnesium plant just north of Austin. It was a war-induced plant. And why it was placed quite right there, I don't know, but they transported the dolomite from West Texas to there, and the idea was to produce magnesium from that dolomite. International Chemicals designed it and operated it. And this guy worked for him. He was a BS chemist. He came down, that closed. See, this, I got there early 45. War was over late 45. This thing must have closed in the summer of 45. Never produced any magnesium, or not a couple thousand pounds of it. And he came down to the lab looking for somebody to work with. Told him Shock, Dorsey Shock. And he was a pragmatic type. He was not really, you know, an academic researcher. And he did do a master's program with me, but I told him, you know, he wasn't going to do the kind of research that a final oral committee would agree to, unless you want to go over to chemical engineering. But he didn't want to do that, and instead, I had a number of practical problems being offered to me. I got in to do it. He took space in my lab. But it became evident that there were going to be more things to do than were properly to be done in the academic building. And the magnesium plant had meanwhile been given to the university. And they were looking for things to do out there. And I said, why don't we set up a corrosion research lab? And we took over one of the change houses, rebuilt it as a lab, and Shock went out there to work on it. That's where that came from. We had a few grants and contracts and things of that sort. And he did a lot of practical work. It was known as the Off-Campus Research Center, or the sometimes called Off-Center Research Campus. It limped along. There was a lot of space, you know, there were 300 acres or so, and a lot of buildings, old change buildings and chemical buildings. We put an accelerator out there while I was vice president, I guess. And it now is a very important part of the University of Texas complex. It is the Balcones Research Center, and it has, my guess is, 700,000 square feet of space, and a variety of laboratories and other kinds of things. So it has become a very important, that's where MCC is, as a matter of fact, the Microelectronics Computer Center. But it started from this little, almost wasted change room. By the way, that laboratory is still out there. It's not a corrosion research lab anymore. But that was the genesis of it, and that went on until Shock was picked up by Conoco. He went up to their research lab in Ponca City and became ultimately director of chemical research. And when he left, the corrosion research lab went.
I noticed too that you also had some early support by Research Corporation.
Yeah.
And then I guess ONR.
ONR started very quite early, 46 I guess it was.
O&R was my main support system. In fact, the first papers came from ORI, the Office of Research and Inventions. And for about 6 months I was under that, just by a letter agreement. And it converted to, then the Navy converted to Office of Naval Research. And that went on until from 1946 to 1968, without proposal. As I remember, it was every December I'd write them a letter of what we'd done, tying some reprints to it, and what we would do. They sent more money. And they kept doing it for 22 years. I thought that was pretty good. We got a lot of work done for them, though. One of the things they wanted was for me to get directly involved in their problems, and that I didn't think was a good idea. Not that they didn't have problems, or not that I might not be able to help them, but I thought that that's where I got the germ of this. I thought that the important thing was that in the process of carrying on this research, which could be useful to them as well as others, I had a pretty good stream of people coming through. I've had about 60 or 70 graduate degrees, 60 PhDs, and maybe 8 or 10 masters. And that was what was important to them. And we should come back to that on science policy. But, yeah, I think we better go.
Okay.
Is this a good place to stop?
Yeah, I think this is an excellent place to stop. Yeah.